Blog Talk Radio.
Hey there. Today we have a good show, really. We have people talking about their experience on Mayan ruins, which is kind of cool. I think you're going to enjoy hearing what they went through when they were challenged with climbing Mayan pyramids. I've been doing it for years, but if you're new to climbing ancient ruins, sometimes it can be a little harrowing, but hey, everybody gets through. We make sure that each person on the tour is a pro by the end of the week-to-week program that we do. We're also going to hear from Mary Joyce, editor of Ships Over Cashiers, on the latest news from around the United States. She is a ancient America enthusiast. We're looking forward to that. Ashley Cowie brings us news from South America. We're going to be bringing you a new sponsor today, a new travel sponsor. I think you're really going to love it. And we have today's interview, computer programmer and specialist Tom Bunzel, who wrote a book called If DNA is Software. Hey, who wrote the program? That's a great thought, isn't it? All this and the news today on Earth Ancients. For November 4th, 2017, this is Earth Ancients. I'm your host, Cliff Dunning. Okay, well, I'm back. I'm still jet lagged. It's a late program. I tried to pull it together to get it together to you on the 4th, but hey, I had a great time. The people that travel with me all were fantastic. We had a group from around the country join me in this trip. Started on the 28th of October and went till the 4th. I stayed and I left on the 6th early in the morning. And Mexico is a delight. You know, we have a president who just doesn't get it. I mean, I've been going down there for 20 years. Those are amazingly sweet, gentle, passionate people in Mexico, the Yucatanians, the Maya, and the Mexicans who live in northern Yucatan are really accommodating. I mean, we've been friends with the Mexicans for, you know, over 100 years, and here's this clown in office that wants to shut the borders down. See, the real thing, the problem is the guy doesn't really travel enough. I mean, if he traveled enough, he'd go, okay, we're all one big world. And, you know, if you're going to cause trouble, hey, we're going to find out. We're not going to let you in. But those people in the north and south of the United States, we've been hanging with these people forever. So anyhow, I was sad to hear that. It kind of bugged me. Even the hotel support was asking me, what's going on? You know, why aren't we friends anymore? So I'm not going to get political on you. I promise that to you, but boy, we got some thinking to do. Anyhow, I don't want to get political. Okay. So anyhow, I had a great time. We had a great time. We traveled to Mayapan. We traveled to Uxmal. We traveled to Zabil Shatun, we traveled to Enza, Oknitok, Labna. Hey, it was cool because we were out in the jungle and one of the one of the group we were with pointed out what looked like a small hill, and our tour guide, Guillermo Gonzalez, he goes by Mimo, M-E-M-O, said that they had found a new pyramid, and Actually, well, when they say new, it's they discovered it 10 years ago. But it hasn't really been excavated yet. But, oh, my God, it was gorgeous right next to our walking area. Love to see this thing. So, but anyhow, over the last few days and into the middle of this last week, I've posted photographs from the tour. You can see them on the Facebook page and on the website, earthancients.com. And thankfully, our tour guide, Mimo, posted things too. So we have quite a nice collection of the tour. For those of you who missed out, were not able to join us, and for those of you who just couldn't, or I mean, there's no way you're going to do a tour, you can go to these, go to website, go to Facebook and see the photographs that we took. And there's even some really cool videos. There's a video which I need to rename it, but it's actually the pyramid Kukulcan at Mayapan, and it is showing people's first attempt in climbing the stairs of a Mayan pyramid. And it's, I mean, everybody did really, really well. Have photographs of a number of really interesting stoneworks and sculptures. One of the sculptures is a stele, a standing Maya stone, is called Spaceman. And when you check it out, you'll see why. Now, this sculpture was excavated 40, 50 years ago. I discovered it in a Campeche newspaper, and I was stunned. I was stunned. And what it is basically is a individual in full space suit. And you can see a video of me talking about it on the Facebook page. This individual is carrying some kind of a weapon. And it's not a staff. It is a weapon because he's holding it with caution. He's like, you know, don't get close to me or the thing is going to go off. But when I'm down there, it's so obvious that we're eyeing generations of Maya people spanning thousands of years. Not a few hundred, not the people who the Spaniards met. Those were the last of the Maya. They had de-evolved bloodletting and sacrificial ceremonies. That's not what the true nature of the Maya were. When you go to these sites, these places are genius works of art that took scientists and it took engineers and expert construction teams to place these Mayan pyramid complexes in such a way that they have stood the test of time for thousands of years. They're just amazing to behold. So again, there's a number of wonderful galleries. There's a gallery of early figurine sculptures that show that just, you know, the is equal to Egypt, anything in the early Roman period. Just masterful artisans. Also, photos of the architecture in these buildings that I've taken. And I haven't even really unloaded my high-end camera. I was using a lot of photos with my iPhone camera, which works pretty good, but I made a special attempt to bring my my Canon, and I have some wonderful photographs that I will share with you later this year. But we're already planning our upcoming trip to the Yucatan, and a little bit later in the show, I will introduce you to our new travel sponsor. I'm really excited about these guys, and we're going to be planning some fantastic trips around Central and South America, to Europe, to a number of places, with what you can might even consider the Earth Ancient travel team. If you hear me sniffling during the show, you go, "Oh, what's that all about? What's Cliff up to?" Well, it's me with I don't know. I got a cold or something. So hopefully I'll get rid of it soon. So, hey, I'm going to be talking about Yucatan and the Maya onward for the next couple of weeks, because we have a lot to talk about, a lot of new discoveries. I went to a new site in Campeche. It is called Edzna, and I was blown away. And I've been coming down here for over 20 years. This site is a magnificent site. We all got a chance to see it up close and personal. I posted a photograph, a 360-degree photograph of the main Acropolis with this five-story pyramid and the surrounding buildings. And I was just had a great time doing and seeing that, climbing around. I mean, it was a great trip. And like I said, I'm going to be talking about it for the next couple of weeks and what's coming up to do, what we're planning for 2018. If you didn't get a chance to come with me, definitely put it on your calendar when it comes up, because it's probably going to sell out. We had to cut the time off for registration earlier than I had hoped, and about 10 more people were hoping to come along. So those of you who didn't get on, stay tuned, 2018. Hey, Earth Ancients is sponsored by Gaia, and Gaia is not only supporting Earth Ancients, but they have over 6,000 titles of subject matter that we cover here, including most of our authors. Eric Von Däniken's latest program called Return of the Gods, and we're going to have Eric on the show in December. He's already confirmed with us. He's going to be promoting his new book, and Eric won't be coming to America, but this new book will be out and available, and so we'll have him on the show. So really, Earth Ancients is a part of Gaia in a big way, and Gaia is offering a program. I talk about it all the time. Go to Gaia, GAIA.com/Earth Ancients. And what's the special? 99¢ for your first month. You get access to everything. You have access to over, I think it's 6,000, now up to about 800 titles. Everything you can think of that is featured here. If you're thinking about meditation, when I start talking about meditation later in the show, you're going to go, hey, I got to check that out. I got to get some meditation. And hey, it's easy to learn. All you got to do is go online I used to not think that was a way to do it, but now people are learning quickly how to do meditation online. You can do yoga. You can do a lot of that other stuff. Check it out. I think you're really going to like it. Gaia.com/Earth Ancients. You know, one of the fun aspects of taking a private tour is that you're not really bothered by the general public for the most part. And we had a small group of about total size of the group was 10 people. And I hope you're listening, guys and gals. You were fantastic. And the tour started off small. We went to smaller places, then we got bigger, 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 bigger. And then at the end, it was kind of a relaxing day. But our first stop was at Mayapan, and we went to the Kukulcan Pyramid, which is the main pyramid there. And there's a lot of other things to see there. But everybody was up for climbing the pyramid. And so everybody was getting up there, and it was a trial and tribulation for some, because when you look up it, I mean, it's almost like a 40 degree or 45 degree angle. The stairs are small. A good portion of the staircase is dissolved. When you take a look at the video on the Facebook page of Mayapan and people climbing it, you'll see that it's a little intimidating. And in some cases the team would help others. You know, we're all about each other. Make sure you get up. And this is not like an endurance race. This is fun, my friends. This is really, really fun. But anyhow, everybody got to the top of this pyramid. And I wanted to interview a couple of people. So I spoke with Lisa from Portugal and Fong from Australia. And here's what they had to say. So I'm here at the Mayapan, and we're standing on top of the El Castillo.
And I just learned that there's a suspicion that it could be under a cenote. And I was here back 12 years ago. What was it? 2005. And it's been beautifully reconditioned and reconsolidated. It looks nothing like I saw it. I asked people on our tour what they were feeling. No one's really said anything yet, but I suspect that in the evening they'll begin thinking about what they've incurred and what they've experienced. But I want to ask a couple people why we're standing here on top of the tallest pyramid at Mayapan, what their sense is. So we have Fung here. Fung came all the way from Australia to experience the tour. Fung, what's your sense of this pyramid?
It's really amazing. It's just that the sense of calm up here. It's because we're on top of the tree line and we're looking around, and it's a 360-degree panoramic view. And Yucatan is just so flat. So once you're up here, you just feel like you're really on top of the world, and the calmness is what really stands out for me.
I know we're looking out here. We have an amazing view, and it's like miles and miles and miles of open space. And when we just also learned that there's thousands of undiscovered cities around here. What do you think of that?
Yeah, it's really amazing. And the other thing was, I was just lying down at the center, at the top of this pyramid, and yeah, you can certainly feel a sense of energy of this place.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah. So the suspicion that they have of cenotes and probably lying underneath a ley line, which is a telluric field that's bubbling up, shows that this is still active. And before the elder Humbat's men passed away, he mentioned that these places had been activated again. So beautiful. All right. So Lisa, who has come from Portugal, has just done a quiet time here at the top of the pyramid. I wanted to ask her what her experience is. Lisa, what did you feel?
So I'm sitting on my bottom with my hands and feet on the ground. And after a while, it just feels very, very peaceful. And then you feel the power, the energy tingling through the hands. And it comes up through the hands. Nothing through the legs, I felt. And then it feels like an energy activation from below the heart. And then it goes up to just above the throat area. And then goes to the upper arms. And it's like you're just receiving this beautiful energy. You just want to sit there forever.
Does it feel odd to you in any way, or does it feel natural, like
natural? Natural, beautiful, peaceful, nothing odd at all.
Like, my guess is that this is a machine of some type that was designed to not only capture the energy, but also manage it in such a way that it actually enhances it.
Well, I could just feel power. Doesn't feel electrical. It feels natural power. And what it was used for, I don't know, but it's definitely very charged, but a positive charge. I don't feel any negativity at all. So peaceful and amazing.
Wonderful. Well, this is the first site we're checking out, so we'll come back and ask you again when we go to some of the other pyramids what your sensation is. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So these pyramids, it's hard to say what the energy is. It's like something natural, but everybody felt something. Everybody had some sensations. Some people are like, what's this buzzing in my feet? So, but it's really fun to stand up on top of these pyramids and get a sense of what the landscape must have been like thousands of years ago. And again, in the beginning of this recording, I mentioned that they have determined and found, you know, several hundred clustered pyramids around Mayapan. And Mayapan's only been excavated maybe less than 18%. So that's a lot of building architecture that's still buried. So who knows what else they're going to find. But anyhow, it's a great tour. And we had good time. A couple of weeks ago, I mentioned that we had a new sponsor that was coming on to Earth Ancients, and I wanted to introduce this new company. It's called Vital Transport, and I have the president of the company, Michael Lundquist, on with me right now. And Mike, how you doing?
I'm doing great today, Cliff. How are you?
I'm good. Hey, I wanted to just talk a little bit about your service. We talked a little bit a while ago on, you know, some of the ideas we're going to have about travel and how you've been around. And, you know, I really like the fact that you have been listening for a while. You're a fan of the show. And
yep.
I'm always looking for good agencies, good tour and travel companies that kind of have an understanding of what we're looking for, which is a lot of times the ancient unknown locations or ancient sites around the world. And talk a little bit about the company, Mike. Tell us what you're all about.
Yeah. Well, I've been in the travel hospitality business now for about 15 years, Cliff. And, you know, I've worked for a couple of different companies before I decided to go out on my own and start my own travel agency, which I started off with a group focus. I've always worked with groups. And, you know, my background traveling with groups and selling groups and having a sales team in the past sent me a lot of different places. And, you know, the first really, you know, when I went to Peru and I went to this pre-Columbian art museum and I saw a couple of these sculptures and I just, you know, talked to one of the, you know, curators there and was just like,
right,
you know, telling them this is what this looks like to me. And, you know, they just kind of explained to me a very brief explanation that they kind of disagree with a lot of maybe the archaeology and things, dates that I knew. And then, you know, I went on to see Sacsayhuaman in Peru and Machu Picchu.
Yeah.
And it started this exploration in my mind, which I was able to combine with my passion for travel. And so that's where I kind of got the idea to start the company. And, you know, listening to the show and just, you know, my passion for travel, I like to go to ancient, mysterious places. You know, and it doesn't have to be always as ancient as Egypt and some of the things you guys talk about, the Mayas and things like that, although I love that stuff. But, you know, we always want to look for some sort of mystery or history in the travels that we do.
Fantastic. So we're going to work together to come up with some tours, but I want you listeners to know that Vital Transport is your one stop for not only finding out what's going on, but give them a call. Have them book your travel for you. They have a complete service. You can give them a call, and they will help you not only set up your flights or your whatever your transportation is, but hey, they can help you with some great tours too. Hey, Mike, what's the phone number? What's the number they can call?
Absolutely. We have a toll-free number, Cliff. It's 844-368-4825. And there's always, you know, that's always going to ring into information line. And, you know, they can dial in extensions. But the most important thing they can do is they can leave a message. If they don't get me, I'm able to get back to them really, really quickly. I always, always offer my service to anybody that calls. And advice is always free. I like to give my travel advice to people, especially with the airlines now. Some of the stuff can be confusing. But we're a full-service travel agency. We can book your air, we can book your hotel, we can book tours, we can book an entire tour for you. If you just want to go lay on a beach close to Mayan pyramids in, you know, in things in Mexico, or see something in Costa Rica, we can book something leisure for you. So, you know, I'm a customization specialist. That's why I like to book with groups. That's why I like to work with people that like to use a travel agent, because they like to customize. They like things to be done for them when they get there, and not done for them in a a sense that's generic at all, in a sense that, you know, makes the trip more enthralling and, you know, gets them around lines and things like that. You know, you know, there's tours that can get you in to almost every site in the world. But, you know, these are the things we need to plan in advance. If anybody's ever shown up in Rome and decided to go see the Vatican one day, which a lot of Americans have, I think they know what I'm talking about with lines and things. So, you know, there are benefits to travel out there, and we're happy to work with everybody. We have a staff that's ready to go for you, whether you're a group or an individual.
Of all the boys I've known, and I've known some.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Coming to you live from around the world, it's Earth Ancient News.
Hey, and the big news actually from late last week was the discovery of chambers in the Cheops pyramid. And a team of scientists from Japan and France used a new and found one cavity at 30 millimeters long. That's almost 100 feet by a few feet tall. They're still figuring out how tall it is. But this is a fabulous discovery, simply because it's never been seen before. It hasn't been pierced or opened by any early pyramid explorers who tried blasting away. And there's another smaller room that has a similar size height, but not as wide. There's tremendous speculation about these by the Egyptian government. The Egyptian government takes a long time. They were a little upset that this news was broken without them knowing it, because probably they would have squelched it and done something with it. So, but there's a lot of controversy. Mark Lariner, the American Egyptologist in charge of Egypt studies, you know, he says it's a questionable discovery. I mean, these are the old school clowns, I'm going to say, that just cannot accept change. I really like this kind of information, simply because as our technology gets more sophisticated, they are able to not only pierce stone, begin imaging like a X-ray, what's inside these cavities. And there's going to be some way to get up there. I think they're talking about getting up high, climbing, scaling the pyramid, piercing close to the area where this cavity is with a drill, and running a camera in there to see what is going on. So I love the fact that they're going to get to the root of it. Now, what if they find something significant? The Hall of Records. I don't know. I would love to know what the heck is going on with that pyramid, because there's so much speculation. But this is a great discovery. It's a you know, one of those amazing discoveries. You can also scroll down and find other articles about that, the pyramid discovery. A lot of galleries this week. I've placed about three, from Mimo Gonzalez, who was the tour guide for our Yucatan tour. Many of them are outstanding, showing buildings at Mayapan, Uxmal, and even parts of Chichen Itza. So there's galleries there. There's also a couple of galleries using the 360 technology that some of the phones have. Check out the gallery called the Main Acropolis at Edzna Campeche. It is very, very cool. It shows you the five-story building, but it also shows you a small acropolis. And Fung is one of our tour guests, is sitting on the main platform in the center of the acropolis. And we both were mentioning, in fact, I mentioned to him the amount of energy coming out of that platform. It's a small platform, and you can see him sitting there. I jumped off, and I'm walking around with my camera. But check it out. There's, like I said, a number of galleries, a number of 360s of our tour. I also want to mention, I placed a photograph with part of an article as a follow-up to my cultural migration article a couple of weeks ago in Ancient Origins magazine. And this is a Egyptian figure that's found in Zabil Shatun, which is just above Mareda in a small ruin. And Zabil Shatun is famous for not only its Sakbi, the Mayan White Road, but for a observatory called the House of the Seven Dolls, because seven dolls were found there. And it's an observatory that's extremely accurate. So I have a few of my photographs there too. So anyhow, lots of great photographs on the Facebook page. And I hope that you do try to spend a little time taking a look and seeing what is there to check out.
Yo te lo dije, no me iba a enamorar. Te lo advertí a ti, my girl. Que al otro día nos íbamos a olvidar. Que no nos íbamos a llamar. Yo te lo dije, no me iba a enamorar. Te lo advertí a ti, my girl. Que al otro día nos íbamos a olvidar. Que no nos íbamos a llamar. Una noche sin compromiso. Lo que pasó fue sin previo aviso.
Hey, we have a special sponsor that's working with us for the next couple of months. It's Harry's. Now, if you don't know who Harry's is, they are a company, a small company that has developed a razor that I've been using now for about 8 months. And this razor is amazing. It's five different blades, a special design, and it's made from a special, unique steel that is made in, is actually produced in Germany. And I love it because it lasts double what Gillette or some of these other blades use for their steel. And it's really a pleasure to have them on the program. Hopefully it'll be for more than a few months. And what they're doing, they're offering a free trial. I can't believe this. You get a new razor handle. You get the blades with a lubricating strip, and you get a lather gel package, all in a container for free. It's a free offer, and they want people to check out their new package. It's kind of a winner deal, I guess. And all you got to do is go to harrys.com/earthancients, and up on the top it says try product. Click that, and you can get the whole thing. I think it's about $13 value for free. For free. Yeah, you just get the, you just press the click thing, and that's it. You're done. So, I mean, I've been using it, and normally I'd say, well, here it is, and it's a good product. It really works well, you know, and not really know about it. But the cool thing about this is you've been using it for almost a year, and it's a great, great product. It's two guys who came together, Jeff and Andy. They were really tired of buying the overpriced razors, and they were entrepreneurs, two young guys, and they started their own company. And they were actually even sued by the big guys because they were competing with them. Of course, they didn't get anywhere. The big guys sued them, but they had to pull the plug on their lawsuit because they had nothing to sue them for. Harry's has a better product. Check it out. It's free. Go to Harry's, HRRYS.com/earthancients, and go to the top and click on the free trial. $13 value for free. Sign up. You are going to be amazed. Harry's. It's a cool product. Always good to hear from Mary Joyce, coming to us from North Carolina. Mary is the editor of Skyships Over Cashiers, a fun newspaper that covers a lot of anomalous material from around the world. Here's Mary. So I thought it was a good time to check in with Mary Joyce, the editor of SkyshipsOverCashiers.com, just simply because she not only is a regular research investigator of a lot of anomalous material on the East Coast, but she also covers other parts of the United States. And it's always good to check in with her to see what is happening and just get a different perspective. Mary, how are you?
I'm fine. I'm glad we connected before you go tripping off to Mexico.
Yeah, I'm about ready to jump on a plane and head south of the border. So we initially communicated, and you had some new interesting bits of research regarding two ancient petroglyphs in the North Carolina mountains. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Okay, there's one that some of the people here locally would know about. It's called Judicolor Rock, and it's the largest petroglyph in the state. And let me just briefly tell you about the size of it. It's like an artist board because it's at an angle, and it's all flat on one side, but it's tipped like a drawing board. And mm-hmm. it's about 20 feet across and 15 feet deep. It has all sorts of markings all over it. And even though we are in Cherokee territory here in the western North Carolina, the Cherokee have not been able to decipher any meaning out of this. Now, it gets more interesting because when I did the research for my book, Cherokee Little People Were Real, I found out that the little people apparently were here before the Cherokee arrived. And the Cherokee came from the Great Lakes region back about 11,000 years ago, according to their own history. Mm-hmm. And in the book, I get into a lot of the evidence that the little people did live in this area. There's evidence of them being around this rock, this Judicolor Rock, and you can't help but wonder if maybe they're the ones that actually did the carvings on this rock. Not only that, but back in 1940, there was a very monstrous flood of the Tuckasegee River, and tons of soil was washed away. And there was a medallion that was found after the flood, and it was maybe an inch and a half in length, oval shape, had like a leprechaun's face on each side of it. Very ancient and very heavy metal. It apparently had been cast at some point because there is a faint edge of a seam all the way around it. So here you have a leprechaun-type face near this Judicolor Rock, you know, both indicating some, you know, very ancient possible little people activity. So they may be mm-hmm. responsible for all these drawings. The other thing of interest with this Judicolor Rock ties in with the Indian legends. And Judicolor is the English way of pronouncing the Cherokee word, which I do not know how to say. And Judicolor was a giant that would leap across the mountains. And some of the legends just talk about one giant. Mm-hmm. Some of them talk about multiple ones. Well, I've interviewed people not that far from this rock who have had encounters with Bigfoot. And again, I can't help but wonder if the old legends that they associate with this rock and the Judicolor giant might be the Bigfoot. So those
interesting.
Yeah, it just the imagination kind of goes wild with it. But there's enough.
Can you send me a photograph, Mary, that we can post on our Facebook page? Because I'd love to see a picture of it, or maybe just the link to the article with a photograph of this Judicolor Rock. I think it's
I can do that. And again, if people are really interested in this kind of topic, the book is available on Amazon. And again, it's Cherokee Little People Were Real. Now, I did the initial research for that book back in 2000, 2001, and mm-hmm. then I kept hearing mostly the Cherokee telling me that there were still little people in the area. And they always told me this with great conviction, but there was never any evidence. And we just posted about a week or so, no more than a week ago, a photograph of something that may be a little person, and it was caught on somebody's game camera. some people at first, or the people who got the picture, they thought it might be an apparition or it might be, you know, a little figure of some kind. What was interesting was a full color concentration of the photo that they got, and the little figure turned magenta. And I began to wonder about that, and I started doing the same thing with a whole bunch of different ghost pictures, and I included one in the article that we posted. And anything that was a ghost or an apparition did not turn magenta. So the fact that this thing that might get passed off as an apparition indicates that it is something alive and you know, breathing, because it did change color.
Now, I'm on your website. Do you have that photograph of that little person on Editor's Corner, Skyship Articles? Where is that?
Let's see.
Because I want to make sure people can see these photographs.
It's on the list, on the homepage. On the right-hand side, there's a column of the most recent things that have been posted, and about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 from the top, I think I counted right, it says Game Cam Photos.
Cherokee
Little Person. If you click on that, it'll take you right there.
I see it. There it is. Okay. Wonderful. Wow. Okay.
No, it's not,
there you
it's
go.
It's not absolutely. Well, what makes this even better is, you know, when you get involved with things like on YouTube, you never know if somebody has been doing Photoshop. I mean, Photoshop is the bane of researchers anymore.
Oh, God.
But
I personally have known
the couple who took this, and I've known them for years, and they're not about to start lying to me. And and they even held on to it for, you know, weeks or a month or so before they even shared it with me. So I personally have confidence in the people that gave me the photo. If I'd seen the same thing on YouTube, I probably wouldn't have posted it.
Interesting. Tell me about this other little people of Eastern Tennessee who are associated with, the Uchi tribe?
The Uchi tribe. Actually, there's a ton of information on that. Let's see if I can be good at boiling it down. Two of us from the website went to visit this land, and it's about 200 acres that's been in a family for generations. And the family has a link to the Uchi Indians, which was a very unusual Indian tribe because they looked very European. And just when I was doing the research on this, I stumbled across some brand new research by a man who is an expert in southeastern Indian cultures. And off the top of my head, I cannot bring his name up to the top of my head. But he said that he had discovered that back in, 2,000 years ago or more, there was a major flood in Ireland, and the people escaped, and some of them landed where Savannah is now, the Savannah River, and then some of them went up into Tennessee through the rivers and ended up settling there. So this tribe, the Uchis, there's hardly any of them left, because they look so European. They just blended right in, and they may very well have been European. What was very interesting is that the little people in the woods and going underground on this land didn't in any way appear to be like the Cherokee little people. They looked European, too, and they wore leather pants, or kind of like the lederhosen. You know, totally different, but the commonality is that they're all about 3.5 feet tall.
Interesting.
Yeah,
wow.
And so let's see. If we have a section, let me get back here so I can give people good directions. Back on the homepage, we have a section, ETs, Bigfoot, and Other Beings. And we've got, broke it up into four articles about the little people in Eastern Tennessee. And let's see. I wish I could remember all the stuff that we do. I think it was.
You have such great articles in here, and that's why I wanted
always
to check
trust,
in with you.
Always trust my articles and not what I say off the top of my head, because when it goes into words, then I am double checking every which way before it gets printed. But when I talk off the top of my head, my memory doesn't recall absolutely everything.
For those of you listening, to go to Mary Joyce's page, it's I'm going to have it on the Facebook page, and it'll automatically populate the website. But it's Sky Ships Over Cashiers, CASHIERS.com. And she has just a great, great collection of articles and photos and graphs and everything. It's just really great.
The articles about the little people with the Uchi tribe are all in the 2016 archive, so it goes back to a year ago last spring. And I'll just rattle off the titles. One is Ancient Race of Little People Still Live in Tennessee. Another one is The Little People Love to Sing and Dance. Third one is How One Man Communicates with the Little People. And the last one is Little People Talk About God, Religion, and ETs.
Wow, amazing. Well, hey, it was great speaking with you. I just wanted to check in really quick. And before I let you go, tell us about this six-finger Bigfoot that you write about. I find that interesting.
I found out that information from David Ellis, who is with the Olympic Project out in Washington. And it's a group of researchers with various kinds of technical backgrounds. And he found this place that he calls the Bigfoot Kids Playground. And they have six digits. And we've got pictures of that on the website in that same section about ETs and Bigfoot. And when I heard about that, I thought, that's really unusual. I've really mostly heard about five-fingered Bigfoot. And the more research I found is that they're not all the same. Some have six toes or six fingers, some have five like we do, and some only have three or four. So there's some anomalies within the whole Bigfoot phenomena.
Wow, amazing. All right, Mary Joyce, as always, it's a pleasure talking with you, and you have I'm looking at this photograph right now before I let you go of the best ever crash photo ever taken, which is at CCTV in Brazil. Doesn't say when it was taken, but oh wait, 2000? No, it's another time. I can't believe it. It's just amazing how much more photos of these anomalous beings there is in Central and South America. It's just very strange. So,
well, since you're headed to Mexico, there are stories about the little people in Mexico. and I don't know how they pronounce it. It looks like it's like spelled P-U-U-K or U-C. It looks like puke to me, but I don't know how they pronounce it. And one man that I interviewed years ago thought that maybe the little people here migrated up from Mexico.
Anything's possible.
Anything's possible.
I'm going to place this web address on our homepage. And you can see all the articles, all the photographs, all the other information that Mary Joyce reports on each week and allow you to see for yourself. So, Mary Joyce, as always, it's a pleasure.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
So now we check in with our South American correspondent, Ashley Cowie. And each week we see what he's up to. We know there's a number of articles that he comes out with. And you can actually read his articles. The guy's prolific. He writes about one article a week. You can go to Ashley Cowie, COWIE.com, and read his bi-monthly articles. And also information on what he's doing. He's in Colombia, South America. So here's Ash. Hey, it's time again to check in with our South American correspondent. Not really a correspondent. He's a writer. He's the host of the People's History Channel in the UK. Our own eyes and ears and other faculties... Ashley Cowie. Ash, what's going on, man?
That was a really interesting introduction. Thank you.
Well, you are our eyes and ears and
You always say I'm your correspondent and then follow up with, but I'm not actually the correspondent. It's really cool.
I just blessed you by saying you're not a correspondent. I said you're the writer and a host, and I cleaned up my act on that one.
Yeah, but it makes me feel quite important. I feel like I should be on Fox News or something, like the correspondent.
Hey, if we had video, I'd make you wear a tie and suit.
What is a suit? What is that?
Uh-oh. Wow, has it been that long? This week you are introducing a new article. It's called The Dragon Slayers, and it's the myths and legends of dragons and fighting the dragons and the various, legends that are all over the world. Now, give me an example of an Asian dragon slayer.
Well, before we get to Asia, what the article is actually is called Dragon Slayers, but what it actually focuses on is the underlying archetypes and what dragons actually mean within myths. So what the article features on is more of the hero than the dragon. So let me ask you a question. Let's look at all of the heroes. Every story that comes out of Hollywood, every book that's been written that's a success follows one pattern, the hero's path. Now, Joseph Campbell in the 1960s wrote a book called The Hero with a Thousand Faces. And he described King Arthur, Neo from The Matrix, Harry Potter, Luke Skywalker. They all follow the same format of a young guy who's in a home setting, a familiar format. And he gets a call to the wild and he steps outside and the next step would be he meets his mentor who, famously would be Yoda. For example, they go on the path, they conquest, and finally meet a dragon or a monster. And it appears in myths all over the world, from Jack the Giant Slayer all the way through, from the Epic of Gilgamesh in prehistory to David and Goliath. Heroes are slaying dragons. Now, what my article goes into is the work of Carl Jung, the forefather of psychoanalysis. He believed the monsters and the dragons of myths represented our own personal monsters within, our own issues, our own jealousies, our own fears. And what I do is I take the legends of heroes and dragons and I tear them apart and show the Jungian archetypes that underlie those myths. So what we're looking at are the psychological patterns within world myths. And it's a wonderful article. It's taken me a long time to research. It's long form. It's about 4,000 words. But what it does is it breaks down that hero versus dragon format and shows what it actually means.
Fascinating. So what countries would you say? Are you doing one in Asia, one in – what is the focus when you say world? What does that mean?
Yeah, so under if you go back to the ancient Egypt, to the Book of the Dead, and go to all of the ancient cultures, you find a symbol. Maybe you've seen it before. It's called the Ouroboros, the circuit, the snake biting its own tail. You've seen that, right? That appears in all world myths. So what I'm doing is rather than focusing on Japan or Russia or North America or Europe, what I'm doing is going beyond location and place and looking at the actual underlying archetype of all of the dragon, all of those myths. But I do focus on a particular myth, a Norse myth, a Viking myth that's based in the north coast of Scotland and in Norway. And it talks about the Midgar serpent, which is the famous world myth, the world serpent of the Norse religions. And what I do is take the hero Asipatel, who faced a massive Sturworm, it was called. It was a world serpent. And I break that myth down in particular. So what I'm doing is, with all this interest in Vikings just now, I've focused on a Viking myth. That's pretty much the only place I can say in the world I've focused on is in the Norse myths.
Cool. All right. Well, that's fascinating. And where can people read this? Where is it going to be located?
AshleyCowie.com. AshleyCowie.com.
Excellent. So I'll make sure that I get a copy of that. Are you going to support this with one of your excellent videos, or is this more of a standalone article?
No, it's going to be a standalone article, but I'm actually going to be traveling to Scotland next week to the location that this myth was based in. So I'm going to take a little 30 or 50 second video short of some of the locations that feature in the myth, but there won't be anything special, but there will be some video there.
Okay, fantastic. Yeah. Ashley, as always, it's a pleasure. It's fascinating, and you always come up with something new. So you are a man of many talents. All right, we'll catch
you
later.
Thank you for your time, Cliff.
This week, author, computer programmer Tom Bunzel asks, if DNA is software, who wrote the code? We'll find out now.
Each week, we feature a guest author, a research investigator, people that are really bringing into question our past, not just our known past, but our unknown past, the possibilities of civilizations who may have existed before our known civilizations, like the Greeks, the Maya, people around different parts of the world that we've known about. And when we talk about pre-dynastic Egyptians, when we talk about the Olmec, the Khmer, people of Indonesia, these people appear evolved and in place, I mean, ready to go from the get-go. There's hardly much of an evolutionary bent. We don't see a great deal of research and development. They appear complete. And this is a question that many of us have had for a long time. And now it appears that highly sophisticated people lived between 9 to 10,000 years ago. And further back, we have Göbekli Tepe, which has been dated to 12,000 years. We have great evidence of really fantastic engineering science in places like the Giza Plateau, the Great Pyramid of Cheops, Pumapuku in Bolivia, even here in the Americas, Teotihuacan in Mexico, which is a sophisticated system of not only pyramids, but now we know there's underground tunnels, there is an electromagnetic system in place, and these don't have dates because they are so old. We can't date them. So current science basically scratches their heads and gives us their best guesstimate about these places according to the current paradigm. So my guest today is quite a unique individual. He was actually selected by Graham Hancock based on an article he submitted on his book. My guest today is Tom Bunzel. Tom has been published in technology fields. He has appeared on Tech TV, Call for Help. He's a speaker at Infocom, and he's written a number of business-related books. But the book I want to focus on today is fantastic. Listen to this title. If DNA is Software, Who Wrote the Code? I mean, that brings up so much possibility. It's crazy. But Tom, I want to welcome you to the program. Thanks for joining me today.
It's really my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
I mean, your book and your articles, If DNA is Software, Who Wrote the Code, brings up a number of profound questions. I mean, where did we come from? Is there a higher intelligence that actually created the DNA that we're made up of? Where did you come up with the concept for this book?
Well, I think this concept was really building in me really my whole life, because as you were describing the ancient civilizations, in my 20s I had an amazing job. I was a tour director and I worked in areas like the Yucatan, And as an irony, a friend of mine that I met in the Yucatan at that time gave me a book, my first book about the Great Pyramid of Cheops. It was by a Mexican author, but given to me in the Yucatan, but it was about Egypt. And it was about more about pyramid power, but it got me interested in the Cheops pyramid. And then I ended up reading the books by the author of The Secret Life of Plants, Peter Tompkins. And so all the mathematical and astrophysical and even astrological relationships that were encoded in it. And then basically I just tried to have a writing career in the movie business in L.A. And in my day job, I had to learn how to use one of the first early word processors. And they gave me like six of these actually really obsolete floppy disks. And I was there at night, and I went put disk 1 through 6 in, and the program trained me on how to use it. And this was like, I think it was like 1982 or 83, before Windows even became. And it blew my mind because I realized that there was it wasn't a real mind in the machine, but there was encoded intelligence in that machine. And that encoded intelligence was able to interact with me. And then I got into programming a little bit, and I got really interested in computers. And as you said, I wrote books about for end users on how to use digital video and digital audio. And then what finally happened was about 6, 7, or 8 years ago, I saw this video. I actually had an idea for a science fiction story about a virus in the brain that would be intelligent, and I was working on thinking about it. And I saw this video on TED, one of the TED videos by a geneticist. His name is Juan Enriquez. He's very, very renowned, very well respected. I think he actually had some work with Craig Venter and the Genome Project and so on. And he was describing genetics from a scientific perspective, the latest findings. And he said, an apple is an application. In other words, it's not like a computer application. It's no longer a metaphor. But an apple is an application. And when it gets enough energy from the sun, it executes its code and it drops from the tree. And then he showed what that code looked like. And he showed pictures of that code. And the code... and I have pictures like this in the book, of course. And the code is really in English. It's A, C, T, and G. We've supplied those symbols, our letters, to represent chemicals that interact very specifically according to very definite rules. And then I put that next to a page of HTML, which I had learned how to, program and so on. And I realized they work the same way. So again, it's not a metaphor that our DNA works like computer code, blah, blah, blah. No, it's operationally identical. And that hit me really deep because of the various experiences, different experiences I had in my life, especially writing as an English major, writing primitive code myself. And I realized code doesn't come out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. Code is encoded intelligence, especially active encoded intelligence, which is what a computer program is. Has to be we call it intellectual property. All the code that we write, right, Apple, Google, Microsoft, and so on, is all protected legally as intellectual property because we recognize it as the product of an intellect, of a mind, of something intentional. So consequently, that opens me up to the question because my original question was, every computer program that we know has been created by teams of programmers. Now, of course, I'll just take a little bit of a detour here. The creationists and the intelligent design people have tried to appropriate this idea to prove an anthropomorphic type of God. I take it in a different direction, and I take it more in the direction that you're going, which is that right. It's really a mystery that's very intimately connected with our origins. And I think that's why Graham liked my stuff, too.
Yeah, no, I mean, the article was fun, and then the book, of course, gets into some real meat. You begin to question about our genome, which have been sequenced and that they pretty much have figured it all out. And as a civilization, our science is really digging into who we are. But I think we need to touch upon some other areas too. And you bring up Deepak Chopra's work on consciousness and its influence perhaps a grand design for who we are. What, how did he influence your thinking?
Well, Deepak has been, I was lucky enough to get to go to a just ended again. I didn't go this year, but Science and Non-Duality Conference. And I think what where Deepak has been so valuable, and another writer that I really admire, Eckhart Tolle, is very valuable, is that they make me, we have this love affair with our intellect, with whatever's going on electrically or cognitively in our brain. But our brain is part of our entire being. And many of the civilizations, like you talked about Egypt, I'm fascinated by ancient Egypt because I believe that they saw the totality of our being and although they memorialized our brain, some of the more recent research has been amazing about finding some of the artistic remnants in some of the temples, actually showing the interior of the brain, including the pineal gland and some of the other parts of the brain. Speculative, I don't know if it's true. But in any event, what Deepak did for, and Eckhart Tolle's work did for me was it opened up my mind to the reality that my conditioned brain is only a small fraction of my ability to know things, that and the science that you described, that is like sequencing the genome, is part of that effort. But when you say that they've uncovered a great deal, they have, but they've also have not been able to know what a lot of the genome is about, and they just call it junk. Where for me, that's a horrible thing to say, because what Deepak, going back to Deepak, the mystery of the totality of it is what enthralls me. The little bit that we've deciphered, which is very valuable because we're curing, we're creating limbs with it, ears. We're curing many, Parkinson's and other diseases with it. We're seeing predispositions genetically. But I think there's an entire vast area of exploration that is still missing, and I think it's in that area of consciousness that Deepak and some of these other thinkers are opening us up to.
Right. Now, you hint in your book of highly advanced people, perhaps pre-Diluvian cultures, who had more of a link to the cosmos. In fact, I'm going to read a section from your book here. You actually say that, this is from your book, the ancient wisdom between science and religion, the awareness of this higher nature of life as the manifestation of an infinite mind was sacred, as were many of the rituals that were meant to preserve this knowledge. Do you believe that these pre-Diluvian people, pre-dynastic individuals, had a link, a conscious link to the higher dimensions?
I suspect that they did. I think that what I'm really interested in with Egypt, for example, is that, from our perspective, our scientific perspective, we look down on ancient Egypt and we say, well, they had all these gods. And so they weren't even monotheistic, and there was a god of this and a god of that. Well, the gods that they had represented actual natural forces, so that they saw the Nile and the flooding of the Nile, which irrigated their crops, which enabled them to thrive and to flourish, as a natural intelligence. And similarly, the movements of the planets were all part of a natural intelligence. They didn't attribute intelligence to the human brain only. They saw intelligence everywhere. And when you really examine the not only the rituals, but the thought processes of the ancient people from their perspective. For example, I remember reading a really interesting story about when we conquered the Old West and they tried to get territory from the Native Americans. The Native Americans didn't believe that some of the tribes, and we can romanticize this, but just think about a worldview that doesn't believe that you can own land. We don't, that's so foreign to our way of thinking. And yet if that is already ingrained in someone experientially and through years of conditioning and it works for them in the way that they interact with the planet, that's a completely different experience of life than we can't even understand it from our industrialized perspective. So from that point of view, I think that the further we are able to go back, if we in fact are, and discover some of the ancient texts, and then some of the greatest philosophers that I've been reading throughout my life have, look at the Library of Alexandria. We know that there was a Library of Alexandria that existed that was burned, that had ancient texts that are completely lost. Yeah. It's unimaginable what might have been in there, and what kinds of philosophies and relationships to the actual cosmos, different kinds of worldviews, different kinds of zeitgeists that could have been, encoded in those texts. So I think our only rational perspective on this is to be completely open to kind of destroying our own conditioned belief systems and seeing what other kinds of belief systems might have been prevalent much prehistory.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about the libraries of Alexandria. It goes through history. We have Padre Diego de Landa landing in Yucatan and burning piles of manuals. I heard from a Spanish archaeologist who believes that there were technical manuals on how to work and operate the observatories at different locations there, and it's a huge loss of resources.
Incalculable. I agree.
Yeah,
an incalculable
insane
loss.
I want to bring up Juan Enrique, his work as a geneticist, but he's also a futurist. You refer to him quite a bit. He impressed you. I did look at the video that you attached to one of your articles, and his TED talk is kind of interesting. But I want to ask you, he says that DNA equals organic programming language. What do you think he meant by that?
Actually, that's my phrase.
Oh,
organic programming language was my phrase.
Okay.
He's saying that he clearly says that DNA operates as a programming language, because he puts a slide up of he said if this program is in your body right now, you're in deep trouble because it's the Ebola virus. Right, and he shows that the ACTG combination code that represents the Ebola virus, and then next to it, I can put up HTML, and the two things kind of up, and they work top down. When he talks about the Apple executing its code, it's left to right, top to bottom, reads across, and then it executes line by line. The programming language that we're talking about with DNA, though, is don't forget that these letters that we've assigned, A, C, T, and G, what they represent are chemicals or proteins. And so it's the proteins that are actually, in the case of computers, it's happening in silicon electrically. In our bodies, it's happening in a whole different way, but it's happening identically. In other words, it's executing a series of instructions that are encoded, but they're encoded chemically. So it takes kind of a leap of imagination to realize that what's happening chemically in our body is the same thing that's happening when you click a mouse on the computer. When you click to run a macro on the computer, which I describe in the book, it executes that code. That stuff's happening in your body all the time. Some of it we can regulate consciously. Most of it is unconscious. And it brings me back to one of my favorite things by Eckhart Tolle, where he says, the intelligence that's harmonizing your body, that's running your digestion, that's running your breathing, that's running your circulation, and all of the different functions of your body, that intelligence is infinitely greater than the cognitive intelligence that's going on in your brain, like we're talking right now. They're different scales, but they're operating the same way, and that's what's so incredible.
Yeah. In your book, you say that software represents active encoded intelligence. And there's been a lot of writing on this from scientific research labs that as they drill down into DNA and find the subatomic particles and things like that, there seems to be some kind of intelligence built into that. Is that when you say active encoded intelligence, it's the same thing as writing a program, wouldn't you say?
It's very similar. I mean, I think that, it is the same thing. So when you write a program, let's say you have a macro is a series of repetitive keystrokes. The example I use in my book, it creates a red rectangle. Then you go into that, into the code, and you change a couple of numbers, and then it's blue. But what happens is that the program actively does it. It draws a blue or red rectangle right in your Word document. Okay, that's what a macro does. So we have encoded intelligence for centuries. We had cave drawings in Lascaux. You had all the different writings that you had. But computer programming represents something completely different because that encoded intelligence is active. It's accomplishing a task. So you can begin to speculate, what is the task? What is the intentionality of the DNA programming? I would submit that it's probably something to do with evolution and also something to do, and obviously survival. So you have to, this harmonizing chemicals that run our bodies are there to keep us alive for the duration of our lives, and they operate the same way as the macro does in Microsoft Word. But every macro or every computer program, I hate to keep repeating this, was created by intelligence, intentionally.
Yeah.
DNA is the only thing we've ever discovered that we don't know its origins. We only know all we've really been, like these new technologies like CRISPR that edit DNA, they're doing is taking what's already there and changing it. They're not creating, and I think what you're alluding to is they're still working with protoplasm. They're still working with whatever life actually is organically, with actual organic compounds and chemicals. And then they reprogram it so that, for example, the great example is bringing back almost extinct animals. And I call it copying and pasting. So in other words, when they resurrect, in the book, the example is something called an Arabian sand cat. It was a species of cat that's almost extinct. So they took the DNA from that animal and they put it into the fertilized egg of a regular similar animal, which is the ordinary house cat. And when the house cat came to term, what came out? The extinct animal, the Arabian sand cat, because they had taken the exact DNA and put it they had copied and pasted. It's like if I wanted to have a picture come up in HTML, what would I do? I would copy and paste the code for that picture into my web page, and then when that code is run through a web browser, that's what's expressed. It's exactly the same principle, and it's mind-boggling.
Yeah. This brings up all kinds of questions ethically. When we start manipulating DNA and people do gene sequencing to remove disease and genetic problems in people, do you think that DNA was designed in such a way that we are allowed to manipulate it? I mean, do you think the future is going to be a place where our parents or parents who want to have children can super manipulate these genetic codes and create super beings?
Well, I think that's absolutely where we're heading. I just saw Blade Runner 2049 yesterday.
Yeah.
And that brings up all kinds of questions. And, of course, in terms of a workforce, a slave workforce, all kinds of dystopian visions. Where I go with it in the book is in a little bit different direction, which is I ask the question, does the programmer have to be – we have this anthropomorphic projection. So does the programmer have to be a human or a being? Or can intelligence or the evolution of intelligence, could it be part of nature itself? And if it is, which I happen to believe that, I'm what they call a pantheist. That's what I have. I think American thinkers like Ralph Waldo Emerson and Thoreau, they were of that same belief system. That's why Thoreau went to Walden Pond for all that time. In any event, if you take that perspective, then this dystopian possibility, which you mentioned, is something that could very well unfold, but we are the agents of our own evolution. And so that if we can connect, as you suggested earlier, if we can somehow connect with that level of intelligence instead of the repetitive intelligence that's chattering in our brains, if we can connect to that greater intelligence, then I don't want to sound too romantic here, but then we get into areas of higher forms from Plato, like love, different interpretations of love, like Eros. And then we would never, if we evolve in that direction, we would never think to use DNA in the negative ways that you just described. We wouldn't use it militarily. We wouldn't use it for slave labor. We would use it as the full expression of the infinite intelligence of nature, of the universe, of existence, and we would be more aligned with the awe or reverent type of perspective to nature that the ancients seem to have had, you know, whether we romanticize that or not. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, here's a question for you, and I have had it partially answered by people like Jim O'Connor, who wrote a new book on plant genetics that the Maya used. Do we have any evidence of programming by ancient people? I mean, I just mentioned the Maya, but not in the same way that we program today. I mean, we have programs to create software that run machines, that have self-intelligence, artificial intelligence. But do you have any reference of ancient people doing some form of programming on some level?
Oh, God. I think they probably didn't think of it as programming, but to the extent that ancient people might have known how to keep their, grow their crops a certain way, manage their families a certain way, they understood the order. You know, one of the words from Egypt that I love is mat, M-A-T, which is this my understanding of it is this universal order. So the order that we superimpose through our science is a very small fraction of an order that's already out there. So to answer your question, I don't know of any specific programming that was done because they didn't create, the Turing machine. They didn't create the calculating capabilities. I don't know. The closest thing I come to is this.
I threw you a curve there, Tom.
Okay. You know, what's the guy's name? Laird something? I forgot his name now. But he studied the the conventional scientists debunk all of this. But he found the Dogon tribe in North Africa and the mystery of how they knew that Sirius had a companion star and so on.
You mean
that tribe?
You're talking about Laird? Laird
Scran, thank you. So in any event, I have his book here. I started looking at it, which is called the Sacred Symbols of the Dogon. And what he discovered or describes, and is speculative, is that their symbology is right out of quantum physics. His theory is that they understood it's not even called mechanics, the workings, the energetic workings of the subatomic world. How'd they get that knowledge? I think his theory is that it came from visitors, extraterrestrials, and that's as good an answer as any. But, is that programming? It's the programming of nature. It's the underpinning of all the material reality that we know about. So do you call that programming or not? I'll leave that up to you.
Yeah. Well, you just brought up something which was my next level of thought on the whole subject, and that is the question of ETs having some major role in Earth humans' evolution. And if, for instance, a genetic scientist that's, say, 1,000 years or more in advance of our current evolution, and they have already gotten to the point where they can create species out of the blue, they can create animals, plant life, food crops, and populate a planet, a barren planet. This is something to consider. Now, you bring up Eric Von Däniken, and Eric's first book, Chariot of the Gods, hints on a lot of this. Where do you fall on this as a potential?
Chariot of the Gods was when I was traveling in my 20s, I came across that book around the same time I was looking at the pyramids, and it blew my mind. I think, you know, Eric as a character, he's a character unto himself. But the stuff that he brings up, some of it can be debunked. But, I mean, when I went to Giza, I saw the pyramid. It's sitting there. It's inexplicable. It's right there in front of me. But, you know, and the same thing with the monuments in Bolivia and South America and Mesoamerica and so on. But what you're talking about, you know, when you were talking about the ancients of, you know, you were talking in terms of 10, 20, 30, maybe even 100,000 years.
Yeah.
What I always think about, and this is, we have to really pay homage to modern astrophysics for this knowledge, but the reality is that the span of the universe is incalculably greater than that. And what we've discovered is that we're like, you know, if the center of the universe is Manhattan, we're out there in the wilds of Canada, so that we're in the boonies. So that to the extent that we may have been influenced by visitors, it would be impossible to think that we wouldn't have been, you know, at some point. In the infinite span of time, which is incomprehensible to us when we look out at the stars and so on. So I think his theories make a lot of sense. The problem is that our current science requires, you know, positive evidence, proof, that kind of thing. And this stuff is still, unfortunately, a lot of it in the realm of speculation and analogy and stuff. But I, you know, from any objective perspective, the idea that we're here and there's nothing else like us anywhere is almost unimaginable. It's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, I have to ask that, I mean, the title of If DNA is Software, Who Wrote the Code? What are the implications of a title like that? I mean, who wrote the code? Do we go religious and say, well, the Lord wrote the code. The Lord created us.
That's the easy way out.
Which is mythological. It's religious. It's dogmatic.
It's the easy way out.
Yeah. Or do we say that there is evidence that we come from a long line of beings that were created, and by the way, we just discovered that the ancient Greeks had a piece of paper that said that we were created from a form of ape man, which there's a number of theories. If you read Zechariah Sitchin's books, he's all about crossbreeding genetic hybrids between the gods and an ape man to create Homo sapiens sapien. There's no proof of that, but there's a lot of people who believe that's the case. But what do you have to say about that title?
Okay. Thanks for the question, because I think it really goes to the heart of it. The reason I put the title together the way I did is because I think the question is what's important. I think if you can be with that question, the same way that you go out into the night and you look at the stars and you say, what's outside? What's the boundary? And the word outside or boundary makes no sense in that context, because you cannot imagine an outside or a beyond. So it goes back to the consciousness issue that Deepak brings up, right? So with this title of this book, it's the same kind of thing, but it's with something we work with every day. So you and I use Microsoft Word or Photoshop every day, and we use code. So we have an intimate connection with how it operates. And now we're confronted with this question to which we really don't have a definitive answer. And the only thing that really comes up is holding the question and letting it expand our consciousness, letting us go beyond the limitations of the kind of program mindset that we find ourselves in now, and perhaps go further. So my intent, and this goes to some philosophy that I don't know, are you familiar with the Gurdjieff-Uspensky work at all? You know what that is?
I don't know about his work. I've read his books, though.
So my favorite person that is really into that right now is a philosopher named Jacob Needleman, and he wrote a book called The Sense of the Cosmos. And I can't do it as well as he did it in the book, but in the last paragraph of the book, he basically says, life is a mystery to be experienced. And the title of my book opens one up, I hope, to that mystery. And it does so through our day-to-day experience with software, but seeing it in the context of the fact that it's part of the Because there's no way. What you bring up, you always kick the can down the road. Did the Anunnaki make us to mine gold for them? Well, then who made the Anunnakis, right? So the
yeah.
Right? So you kick the can down the road. Okay, the Anunnakis came from the center of the galaxy, and they came out of a black hole. I mean, you can come up with any kind of stuff you want. But ultimately, the mystery is within the actual English language of the question. Because the structure of the question is, there must be a programmer in order for there to be a program. But is that true? That is a question that is a philosophical question more than a scientific question. And it's one that some of the greatest philosophers of our time are wrestling with in terms of consciousness. Because if there's consciousness, and we're part of consciousness, whatever that may be, and of course defining it has been impossible, then evolving as having organic evolution with software as an underpinning of it, as DNA, it makes sense in that context. But we have no idea about the whole notion of outside and inside, or beginning or end, no longer makes sense in that context. You have to go beyond those limitations of language and mind in order to come up with anything that comes up with that sounds like an explanation. But I like to summarize, the title to me is like a can opener. It opens the reader up based upon, especially when you read and see how computer software actually works, very basically, to think that our organism is working that way. That opens you up to a mystery or a series of questions, which you're bringing up, which I love, that opens up many other vistas of investigation beyond just regular science.
Right. Okay. What do you feel about early civilizations that we don't know about? I call them the unknown. The known civilizations are the Maya, the Chinese, the Egyptians, the Olmec, people in the Aztecs, people like that. But the pre-Diluvian people, the people that these known civilizations talk about as their mother culture, as where they started from, and we can also look at the Greeks as a known civilization, but it's apparent in your book that they had knowledge far more ancient than they ever could develop. What do you believe these early people were like? They seem to have an exponentially greater intelligence, not only on just mathematics and science, but this ability to tap a universal collective of wisdom. What would you say about them?
Well, I think that at the end of Secrets of the Great Pyramid, the book by Peter Tompkins, he speculates about an Atlantean civilization. And, of course, Plato wrote about that, and Graham Hancock connected that to the sudden appearance of Göbekli Tepe. And I think it makes a lot, that his theory makes a world of sense to me, which is that, you know, maybe and we have all these ancient myths of cataclysm and flood and all that, that the people that you're describing, a few of them survived, so that these great monuments were their attempts, so that's why there was no evolution towards Göbekli Tepe, for example. It came up out of nowhere because they were trying to preserve stuff that they knew was going to be lost as their culture degenerated over time. And so I think there's no doubt that something like that existed on the planet. I think our time scale, and Graham talks about this, how things keep getting older. I think ultimately our time scale has to be infinite because, I mean, can you even conceptualize 4.6 billion years, which is what we now give age of the universe or the time before what we call the Big Bang? I mean, you can use the word 4.6 billion. It's a phrase. What meaning can it have to somebody who lives 70 years, right? It's completely meaningless. So, and we're here. So something like us might have been here always, you know? In fact, one of my favorite things, you're probably familiar with the work of Shlomo de Lubitz, the Egyptologist. His interpretation of the Temple of Luxor, the Temple of Man, and now they've gone even into it with Magical Egypt, where they say in the head in the area of the brain. Again, the various monuments in that temple depict the actual workings of the brain and the actual physical properties of the brain. So what that says to me is that somebody was preserving a teaching from as above, so below, that the human form, the human organism, not the way maybe we're experiencing it in 21st century America, but the way it was meant to be experienced, or the way the form was first idealized, because with Plato it's an idea first and then it becomes manifest in the world, is it has a purpose. It has a purpose of transmuting energies, of evolving, of living experientially, and the universe is getting the energy from that. And I think that that is close. I think the notion of beginning, middle, and an end is part of our, again, anthropomorphic, because we die, notion of life. But if these ancients had a connection to source, whatever that might mean to anybody, then they were basically the instruments through which they began to understand that infinite intelligence and express it somehow, which is what we're doing. But I think we're doing it on a much more mundane, much lower level. I think we're really, I think our science is amazing, but it's really just trying to get back. Like, I think if you speculate that somebody, like, let's think about something like telepathy. We speculate that some people could read other people's minds. Maybe some ancient people could do that. Who knows? We don't know. But now, with our technology, with the internet, we're basically simulating that, right? We no longer have to be in the same place. We have non-locality. We can talk to anybody, like, around the world instantaneously. So with our mechanical or with our material instruments, we're trying to replicate, possibly, this is a friend of mine used to have this theory, that we're trying to replicate powers or sensory capacities that other forms of humans may have had or still have somewhere else, you know, or in the past. I don't know.
Yeah.
These are all possibilities.
By the way, for those of you who are listening, Tom referred to Schwalder Lubitsch, who is a turn-of-the-century archaeologist who studied and wrote a tremendous esoteric book on the structures, the buildings that the Egyptians made. And this is the work that John Anthony West used, not only to discover the Sphinx and the Giza Pyramid, the Giza Plateau, were significantly older. He actually writes in his book, Serpent in the Sky, which is John Anthony West's book, that the writings of Lubitsch really tackle the understanding that these buildings that the Egyptians built were actually living beings or living consciousness. So
living teaching.
Really fantastic. Tom, in the time we have left, why don't you tell us what you hope the reader will get from your book?
Okay. Again, I think the reader can become open to some of the ideas of, for example, Deepak Chopra or Eckhart Tolle by using the book as what you were just describing with the temples of Egypt. It sounds a little grandiose, but as a living teaching that creates a question that opens you up to higher influences, if that's the right word, or a possible connection to a deeper level of thinking or intelligence than the simple logical, structured intelligence that we think is human intelligence, that's the highest thing that there is. And another way of approaching that is, for example, if you think about it, a dolphin or a whale that experiences a completely different world with a giant brain that's bigger than our own, are they thinking with the same logical structure that we are, or are they playing, the humpback whales are playing music? So they're, if I can romanticize this, they might be mathematically in tune with what we might call the music of the spheres at a level that we can't even comprehend. So we now have this experience with computers. We've had computers and software for maybe 30 or 40 years, which is a tiny fraction of the span of human existence that you were just talking about, Cliff, where we talk about human existence, we keep getting older. So in a very tiny fraction of that time, our current people have this experience with software. And now we find that that level of complexity, intelligence, and programming is organically present in our own physiology. That question of its origin and what it means, I think, can open the reader up to exploration way beyond what we generally, and beyond like the superficial religious kinds of answers, oh, God did it. God is, I call God the ultimate variable, and computers, X is the variable, so that if you fill out a form and you put your Tom's first name, X becomes Tom. So it's an empty vessel for meaning. That's what a question is. When you open yourself up to a question of this depth, like when you look out at the stars, I think it can point you in a different level of fulfillment and meaning, and it just opens up many, many doors. It changed my life, and I like to share, and that's what the purpose of the book is, to share that journey with the reader.
You really bring up some great questions. The title of your book's great. If DNA is software, who wrote the code? I just love it. Tom Bunzel, thank you very much for joining me. And, hey, I look forward to some of your future work. I really enjoyed our time together.
I appreciate that very much, Cliff. I had a great time. Thank you very much. I look forward to watching or listening to the podcast when it comes out. Thanks so much.
Okay, that's it for today. I hope you like the show. Stay tuned next week. We got great guests, as always. Lots to check out. Go to the Facebook page and go to the website and see what we got going. Always more to check out. You hear the show every week, but we dump a lot of content on our Facebook page and on the internet on our website. So hope you'll join us. Next week, November 18th, we're talking about ancient America again. This time, it's ancient New York. I think you're going to like the show. All right, be well.